Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, why hunger isn't just about the cost of food, 12 million jobless, why public employment schemes won't fix unemployment, how generative technology can drive real development if used wisely, and why auctions may outsmart traditional markets. It's Thursday, the 16th of October. While South Africa produces some of the most affordable, high-quality food in the world, millions are still struggling to put nutritious meals on the table. And the problem, says Roli van Rienen, who is supply chain executive at the Big Beefmaster Group, isn't about the price of food, it's the economy generally. What am I talking about? Well, high unemployment, rising living costs, and weak consumer spending, all putting a squeeze on both households and the entire agricultural supply chain. So let's explore this in a little bit more detail. Early welcome to you. Let's start with that headline statement. We don't have an affordability problem, but an access problem. What are you actually saying?
Good day, Jeremy, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. I really appreciate that. What I'm actually saying, aren't we actually talking about the state of the economy of this country and those additional costs we incur, whether it is the cost of tires because we drive through potholes, or whether it is hiking electricity prices because there's inefficiency in that, or fuel prices because we don't have really refineries left anymore. Isn't that the cost that's actually eating us up? Getting to work, that's costing us money, whereby our food is actually, compared to world terms, and if you look at the Big Mac index, it's actually quite cheap, actually very cheap.
So there's a real disconnect here. Food is affordable, you're suggesting, yet so many households really are skipping meals, struggling to afford basics like meat and vegetables. How do you bring those two sides closer together so we get a more positive outcome?
We'll have to take a look at the current state of the economy. We'll have to look at better employment. Yes, we do have a tremendously well-established informal sector that's looking after itself to some certain extent. But the money flowing into the country out of international investments is just not enough at this point in time. It is not an investment-friendly country at this point in time. We need money from the outside world to come into South Africa so we have more money in our own pots to enrich the people more in general in South Africa, and not just a few.
So let's talk more broadly then about the supply chain, and how is the pressure on households that you've just outlined for me reverberating back to the agricultural sector, and really with what impact?
Let's understand something about food. It is in general a perishable product. Some have a longer shelf life, some have a shorter shelf life. And if I talk about fresh produce, whether it be vegetables or meat related products, it's highly perishable product. Well, that means that product is priced to sell. It cannot sit on a shelf. It has to sell. So it'll be priced so that it moves within a certain amount of time, that it doesn't perish. That means it's affordable for the consumer at that level, at the rate that it is produced at, and the volumes that it is produced at. So it's balanced at this point in time. If we're going to produce more, the prices might come down a little bit. If we produce less, prices come down. But the biggest factor is if the consumer has less spending money on that product, or less money available at the end of the month to purchase those products and purchase food, then that pricing will come down even further. But the concerning thing is really the consumer itself. As they get more pressurized due to other rising costs, they are cutting on meals. Isn't that actually very tragic at this point?
And really, as far as the agricultural sector is concerned, it's also finding it, I would imagine, increasingly difficult to find that balance that you've just referred to.
Indeed. If you are involved in agriculture in South Africa on a small or medium or large scale, you will understand that you are running a business. That business does have input costs. We just don't rely on rain and good fortunes. There's input costs, there's people who you employ, there's cost of seed or fertilizer, whatever it is that your crops are you're producing, or if in the case in cattle, you have to keep them fed. And those things cost money. And again, as the economy squeezes, costs rise and there's pressure back from consumer, which does place tremendous amount of pressure for the producer themselves. And that's through the entire value chain. So we are all affected by the state of the economy.
So, are there short-term policy or structural changes within the sector, do you think, that would make a difference in ensuring that we can actually access the quality food that is being produced?
Those two are a little bit poles apart, sir. But if I look at structures within our system to produce cheaper product that could address maybe the problem for the consumer, yes, we as the value chain or the production chain, albeit for grains or animal products, if our input costs can come down, we could produce it a more affordable product for the consumer.
Let me look at your specific industry if I can. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, but beef exports are a strong revenue earner for the country. How difficult is it for you to balance global demand that you're probably experiencing right now with also ensuring local access to affordable protein? It's a bit of a tightrope, isn't it?
It is. If we break it down, it does again come down to supply and demand. If another country wishes to purchase our product from South Africa, that product arrives there at a certain cost structure, within a certain cost structure, albeit for transport or whatever the duties might be. So those things balance out supply and demand. And in the end, that also has an effect on our pricing in South Africa.
So, if we don't address the economic conditions behind the food insecurity that we've been talking about, what kind of food landscape are we going to be looking at in the short term?
In the short term, if we don't address those economic, we're going to see more hardship, and we're going to see more problems within rural communities. And look, it's not just the farmer that's affected. I mean, there's a lot of people within the value chain, whether it's the people actually on farm or within the people who are delivering service within that value chain. Those people are going to be affected in the longer run, but in the shorter term, everybody feels a squeeze. And it's like we are all going down further into a spiral dive and a problem.
Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate the honest and the forthright assessment there. That is Roelie van Reenen, who is Supply Chain Executive at the Beef Master Group.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Centre for Development and Enterprise says South Africa's fixation on public employment schemes like the Presidential Employment Stimulus offers only short-term relief and diverts attention from the structural reforms needed to create millions of real jobs. In a compelling argument, Anne Bernstein argues the state keeps backing projects that, in her words, will never generate the millions of jobs that South Africa needs, even as more than 12 million people want work and simply can't find it. Anne Bernstein, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with that core claim then. In plain terms, why do public employment schemes never scale to solve joblessness?
I think that's an important question. Firstly, in public employment schemes are jobs that are created and paid for with state money, your and my taxes. And so there's a real limit on how much you can spend on these jobs, especially in a country with a fiscal crisis. So the one is that, but the second is these are not real jobs. So we're giving somebody something to do, which is better than being unemployed, but they're part-time jobs. They generally last about 78 days, and then you're unemployed again. And so if you're lucky, and there are exceptions, you might learn some skills on the job, but most of the time, people go and they pick up litter, or they get involved in community projects, or whatever the public employment is. But this is not really taking you anywhere. So for a country with the scale of unemployment that we have, this is just not the answer.
So,
and we shouldn't spend so much time on it.
So what I'm going to say is not spending so much time on it, but what you're also suggesting is these schemes detract or distract from reform. So are there one or two reforms that would create then faster, larger job gains within a credible timeline?
Look, the most important change that we need in order to create jobs is to get faster growth. And we do have a reform program, but it's not being implemented with the speed or the urgency or the comprehensiveness that we need. So getting South Africa to grow, not at 1.5%, but at 4% is what we've got to aim for, and we've got to fix all the things that hold us back. That's the most important lever to get jobs. But at the same time, we have aspects of our laws and other institutions that hold our economy back from being labor absorbing. So we've got to make sure that our economy is as labor absorbing as possible. In order to do that, we have to encourage employers to hire people. And that means that, for example, if you want to hire some young person who's never worked before, we need to make that easy. If it doesn't work out, you need to be able to get rid of that person very quickly. So we're saying we need a different approach to probation, a one-year probation period, where you can really get rid of people for all sorts of reasons that they don't fit the job, you know, except, say, race or gender discrimination, the very basic things. That would make employers more likely to hire more people. And there are other things we should do. But we also need to fix our skills system, which is terrible. And if you think of a bad education system, the skills training system becomes even more important. The CETAs, we can't find anybody who's in favor of the CETAs who doesn't work there. And they're not performing their function. The TVET colleges are also not performing well. They're expensive and they're not producing graduates that employers want. So there are lots of things we could be doing today. At the same time as trying to get more growth, we can fix the environment as fast as possible to make this a more labor-absorbing economy.
Anne Bernstein, let's go back to CETAs very quickly. They've been in the headlines for all the wrong reasons for quite a long time. You say they're dysfunctional, they don't work. Do we need them, or would you replace them with something else to make sure that money isn't wasted?
Look, we certainly need more apprenticeships and more learnerships, but we've got to not create new institutions, which the CETAs were. We must rely on business to do that. They know exactly what they want. They should be hiring private training companies or doing it in-house, and we should incentivize that rather than tax them to fund institutions that were set up to deal with skills shortages but aren't performing. So, yes, there's lots we must do, but we need to think in a different way and spend our money and effort in a different ways to make people as ready for employment as possible, and the best people to decide that and what sort of training's needed are companies themselves.
And the current problem, of course, is politics and not economics that is driving decision on job creation in South Africa, but difficult to separate the two, surely.
Absolutely. And we've thought a lot about that. We're clearly in a stalemate, as you know, Jeremy, and we've suggested what China did, for example. There was a stalemate some 30, 40 years ago, and then Deng decided, well, we're going to start a special economic zone where we will try and bring foreign companies in, which many people didn't want, and see what happens. And we're suggesting, and it worked phenomenally. We're saying we're in a big deadlock. Why don't we take Kucha, which already has a lot of public money invested, but is essentially bare felt for most of that zone in the Eastern Cape. There's an underutilized port. Let's try and make this an experiment where you have different labor rules and a few other things, and we try and get new investment to put money into low-skill manufacturing, because we don't have a highly skilled workforce. So we've got to get more and more and more low-skilled employment opportunities. And so we're saying, let's try an experiment. Just give us that space and let's see if it works. If it doesn't, we'll eat our words. If it does, maybe we can start to build a low-skill manufacturing sector that could employ lots and lots of people.
And I wonder whether your organization has crunched the numbers. If the same money was shifted into the private sector from what was happening right now within the public space, do you know how many more real jobs might be created?
Now, that's a very big question. So we haven't, you know, I'm not sure what you're thinking of exactly. The one area where we have thought about this is the government spends about six billion rand a year in promoting small businesses. And we can see where the money is, but we can't see what impact it has. There are no impact assessments that we can find. And we're saying, gee, you know, creating small businesses or identifying dynamic ones with potential is a really hard thing to do. We should give that money to the private sector. Not that they're perfect, but they have much more expertise in doing this than officials who've probably never run a business or don't know much about what makes for a successful business. So if you took some of that 6 billion every year and said to the private sector, compete for this money, tell us what you'll do. And then in a year's time, you are going to report back in a public way, make this transparent and show us what you've achieved. And let's test. Do we get more value for money and more small businesses growing and employing more people if the private sector sort of allocates the money versus whatever is happening in the public sector, which is clearly not working and which is almost like a sort of black box. We can't find any impact analysis. So that would be one example where we're saying, let's use that money differently.
Anne Bernstein, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed from the Center for Development and Enterprise.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, generative AI isn't just shaping how we work. It's fast becoming a powerful tool for achieving national priorities. What am I talking about? Well, things like financial inclusion, energy efficiency, climate resilience. And in a country like ours, battling inequality, unemployment and infrastructure strain, the question for South Africa isn't whether to adopt AI, it's how to do so responsibly and inclusively. It's an important issue. And I'm going to discuss this with Claire Bradbury, who's sustainability lead for Accenture Africa, and let's find out how AI can accelerate process, particularly towards sustainable development goals. Claire, a very warm welcome to you. So on a broad canvas then, what makes AI uniquely capable of bending the development curve and not just nudging it?
Well, thank you so much, Jeremy, for having me. Delighted to be speaking to you about this really critical, urgent issue this morning. So AI is exciting because it offers us the opportunity to catalyze all of the SDG, the Sustainable Development Goal imperatives that South Africa, along with the rest of the world, still needs to be aggressively pursuing. And first and foremost, I think in most of our minds will be energy security. And rapidly behind that would be water security as well. South Africa is one of the most water-stressed countries in the world. So what AI enables us to do, and I will qualify this in a moment, is to understand in real time, for example, where we can save emissions, where are we using the most energy. We can use it in predictive ways to understand where we may have a major flood risk, for example, where critical national infrastructure might be at risk. We can also use it to monitor in real time, again, the degradation of the natural environment. So it's been a really important tool across Africa for biodiversity conservation. It's been absolutely revolutionary in farming all over the world. So we can use it for pest prevention and detection, for example. So, I mean, I could talk to you for our whole time together about all of the opportunities that it brings. But we must couch this for South Africa in terms of the other really systemic challenges that South Africa is dealing with, and AI comes with its own enormous energy usage. So it's really important when we're thinking about this in the South African perspective that this is contributing to South Africa's energy security. It's not a zero-sum game where it's either energy for AI data centers or it's energy for our population.
Claire, the challenge, of course, and you make perfect sense, but we've got to move more rapidly from pilot projects to mass adoption that actually reaches the margins. And I'd suggest to you that that isn't happening quick enough.
I think you're right. We do need to move quickly, but we also need to move very intentionally. And this is a piece that I worry may be left out as we get sort of sucked up by this hype, and generative AI is now being, you know, the hype is merging into agentic AI. So this is a very rapidly moving field. So while we do need to move quickly, it's more important that we move decisively. And there are a couple of reasons for this. So we need to know which AI models we're using. When are we using AI? Is it actually going to contribute to the reasons that we're using it for? Or are we just, you know, sort of going along with this trend? And the reason that that is so important is because of the energy and water usage, primarily. And the other thing is that South Africa is such a diverse population that if we fall into the habit of using large language models that have been developed elsewhere, they run the risk of not necessarily catching the data that we need, the all-important data that's critical to the South Africans. So we need to be thinking about small language models. So we need to be at the table actually developing these models as well.
So how does one go about then building or determining a strategy that talks to your sense of intentionality?
It's a great question. Accenture has a tool called the Sustainable AI Quotient. What we use that for is both as a diagnostic, but also as a strategic tool. And we need to be able to measure, first and foremost, holistically, the true cost of AI. And we have to know what our strategy is for this before we start to implement. So this means, you know, dollar value of the money invested, the megawatt hours of the energy consumed, the tons of CO2 emitted, and the cubic meters of water used. Now, these are the metrics that we've felt up front are really important, and this is very early days. So I think, you know, in years to come, we will see that these metrics have advanced far beyond the sort of classic E component of ESG, if you will. That should be the bedrock in terms of concrete actions.
I want to pick you up on water, if I can, which you suggested was so critical. And there's no doubt that we're staring down a water crisis at the moment. I'd say that it's not necessarily just a data problem. Do you really believe that AI can deliver hard infrastructure solutions, or, as some have suggested, maybe just another layer of tech gloss on a collapsing system?
Well, it very much depends on the integrity of the system that implements it. But it is possible for it to help to provide these solutions. Now, it's a tool. It's not a silver bullet. But it can, when we're talking about data centers, and if we consider local data centers, we can use very water-wise cooling innovations, for example. So this would include evaporative free cooling, heat reuse, water minimization, power consumption, and so on. But we have to, and that's data center specific. When we're talking about mining operations, for example, or municipal infrastructure, we would need to be leaning more on the predictive capabilities of AI to understand where our greatest areas of water stress are. And we need to be able to course correct. So it's not just having the data, it's what we do with it afterwards.
And how do you best course correct then once you have that data? Again, it comes down to the people that are doing that. And potentially we don't, or possibly we don't have that skill set yet.
Well, the course corrections are not unique to the data that comes out of AI. I mean, we know what we need to do in terms of replenishing our wetlands, our water tables, protecting forested areas, for example, which help us enormously with flood defences and climate risk adaptation. So I think you're right. We need to absolutely make sure that we have these skills. But this is about building in sustainability credentials into our education syllabus, whether this is at school and at university, these skills are just as important. These human strategic decision-making skills will be what unlocks the power, or doesn't unlock the power, of AI.
And how important then is a credible AI regulatory regime in that respect?
Well, regulation is always a critical part of the puzzle. It's not the only part, but particularly with AI, we're dealing with the possibility of ethical considerations. And because this is so new and it's happening so quickly, and we already know that digital inclusivity in South Africa could be much stronger and needs to get much stronger, there's a danger that this is something that is happening to South African people and it's not happening with them. And it needs a government regulation that is robust to enable this support, but it must, the government must also be working with businesses. Businesses critically must be reaching out to the government to collaborate on how AI is developing and used, because that is the best way that an informed policy is going to be established.
There's absolutely no doubt this debate is moving so quickly. Claire Bradbury, I do appreciate your time. Sustainability Lead for Accenture Africa. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, auctions these days are not just for art collectors and vintage car enthusiasts. From telecom spectrum and real estate to manufacturing assets, auctions are increasingly being used to allocate high-value resources faster and more transparently, and often more efficiently than traditional negotiated sales. So as economic headwinds start to tighten, understanding how this mechanism works and why it can reshape entire industries has never been more relevant. So I want to get to grips with that with Professor Adrian Saville. He holds a professorship in economics, finance and strategy at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. And as you're about to hear, has some clear thinking on the issue. So Adrian, you call auctions and welcome to you curiously efficient. That's a nice turn of phrase. What makes them more powerful than conventional pricing models?
Jeremy, this is a lovely conversation to have because, you know, I think in part this is likely to be an increasingly important consideration for certain investors. You know, and let's start with South African investors. As public markets have thinned out and become increasingly illiquid with fewer and fewer opportunities, this necessarily forces us to look wider. So, you know, in part, a consideration of auction mechanisms is by necessity born out of our circumstances. And we're putting together a series of five papers, me and my colleague Ian McLeod at the Center for African Management and Markets at Gibbs. And this is a fantastic commission that we've got from a high street auction to talk about, you know, why auction matters. And so to go to, you know, your question specifically, in classic markets, traditional markets as we know them, prices emerge through iteration, through groping, often equated to trying to catch a black cat in a dark room. And what auction does, you know, by design, is it forces information into the open. It reveals what people are actually willing to pay, and it does this in real time. And so just those two ingredients, forcing information into the open and insisting that it is time specific, translates into very big gains in economic efficiency. You also, through auction, are able to remove a lot of the fog of what economists refer to as asymmetric information. In other words, I know something that you don't, and you have to try and make a price for the thing that I've got, and I've got this information monopoly.
So, Adrian, let me push back slightly. You're arguing that auctions offer better price discovery. I understand and acknowledge that, but
absolutely,
doesn't too much transparency risk pushing prices higher than what is perhaps sustainable in the long run?
Oh, you know, absolutely. We've got, and one of the best examples we've got, from recent times was, you know, whether it was really Leonardo Salvador Mundi, it was really Leonardo that that had his hand in that piece of work. And the bidding there went on to, you know, $450 million. This was way beyond what anyone had ever imagined. So absolutely, you know, there are places, just like any other market, or, you know, an auction market to dysfunction. You know, think of Banksy's self-shredding masterpiece, and I can't get my head into how those prices work. But those would be the exception. And generally speaking, where you have relatively thin, relatively illiquid markets in particular, this is a fantastic way to get price discovery. And what we mean by price discovery is you have to put your cards on the table, face up, and we have to find each other quite quickly. Think of, you know, the alternative is illiquid markets where you must hammer up a board outside your home and wait for someone to eventually arrive. No one arrives, and you must then sort of nudge the price lower in the hope that someone comes. And auction wrestles with this. It meets it square on.
You also argue that in markets prone to insider advantage or corruption, auctions can act as a disinfectant. I understand what you're saying, but how realistic is that in countries with weak institutions?
Well, a great example of that is Nigeria's GSM auction in the early 2000s, where at the time, if you were thinking about going into to make a bid for a license, the system was fairly difficult to see through. There had been a recent scandal in India with a similar 2G spectrum sale. And by throwing the doors open to the process, you make the process transparent, you get access to information, and you don't entirely remove any type of risk of patronage, but you certainly sort of rewire the system and help establish more solid. And so we can go to, you know, big thinkers like Douglas North, who underline just how important institutional rules are, and auctions are able to rewrite those rules in markets where you have dysfunction and remove inefficiencies.
Adrian, on the few occasions that I've been to auctions, I've lost my mind. And I think that there's a psychological edge to auctions. And maybe they can drive people to bid beyond rational limits. And it's important, therefore, to balance excitement with outcome. Not always easy to do, though.
Yeah, without question. And I would say the same, Jeremy, in, you know, in any market, whether it's a private sale, whether, you know, you're trying to buy a home on a street that you love, if you're in an auction environment, and of course there is more sort of blood and flesh in the room, which can feed a frenzy. But public markets also, you know, all markets, all activities where human behavior is involved are subject to this type of dysfunction. And so, you know, whether it's a private sale, whether it's an auction, whether it's a public market, one of the first things that we want to get our arms around is our behavior, our irrational behavior, the anxiety that's caused by fear and greed, fear of missing out. Greed causes you to, you know, push prices up, and even sort of saving face where you're participating in an auction, you don't want to be the person that's outbid. So that's the importance of establishing rules for yourself before you participate in any type of investment activity.
All right, a final one then. If auctions, as you have made a case for, can outperform traditional markets, why are more sectors, particularly here, not embracing the model then?
No, that is a curiosity for me. And there are places where alternative assets in particular have an important role to play in individuals' portfolios. If, you know, you look through a conventional portfolio, it's described as a 60-40 portfolio, 60% equities, 40% bonds. Where's the other stuff? And this is, you know, potentially plays a very powerful role, such as in the form of collectibles, stamps, jewelry, handbags, cars, watches, wine, whiskey. Auction will facilitate this. It's a curiosity that South Africa hasn't quite embraced this in the same way, and there's an important role for businesses to play in bringing auctions into the light of day.
Adrian Saville, thank you very much indeed. And that's where we are going to end things. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.